You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions, episode 10. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies.
Hello and welcome to the Tricorder Transmissions. I'm Craig Cohen.
And I'm Jeff Hewlett.
And on this week's episode, we are talking about the Corbomite maneuver. But before we get to that, Jeff, I know last week we were talking about this Star Trek, the original Topps trading card series book, and I know we both got our hands on it.
Yes, I got mine, I think, on Monday afternoon after I got home from work. I was pretty excited about it, and it lived up to the expectations that I had for it, for sure. What about you?
Yeah, and I know we had talked about the bonus cards that come with it.
Yeah.
And it turns out we compared notes, and it is the same set of cards. It's four additional cards that all have the same writing on the background.
Yep.
Indicating that they are bonus cards. And I guess this is cool for people that have the original Topps trading card set, because these are sort of supplemental cards, if you will.
Yeah.
Now, so, let's talk about the physical look of this book first.
Sure.
I really think this is a really, really cool book, and I would love to see more card series done like this. It's got a really cool sort of wax-type book cover on the hardback book, which almost feels like the packaging for an old set of cards.
It does. I was pretty impressed with how close it feels to those. I remember when I was a kid back in the late 70s and early 80s, I did love to buy, you know, packs of cards with the little crappy stick of gum in them.
Yeah.
And it, you know, the waxy pack had a certain feel to it. And I don't know if people who didn't grow up in that time period know that feel, and it's very hard to describe, but if you are in like a Barnes and Noble bookstore and you can physically pick up this book, the dust jacket on the book feels pretty close to what that wax paperish felt like on the outside of the pack.
And have you taken the quote unquote wrapper off of the book?
Yes, I have.
And there's a little surprise there on the front cover, huh?
Yeah, and on the back. So there's the front cover is a stick of gum, and on the back is a broken stick of gum, because a lot of times, of course, when you bought the pack of cards, the stick of gum was broken.
Yeah,
you know, in a million pieces.
So this is it really replicates, you know, pretty much a package of the Star Trek trading cards, and these were from the 76.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And another really cool thing about this book, I'm not all the way through it yet.
Me neither.
But, you know, it basically runs through every card in the series, gives you the front cover and the back cover with a quick write-up. But there's also an introduction where they sort of talk about the history of Star Trek trading cards.
Yeah.
And it was cool to see that there was the first set of trading cards were in 1969 by the A&BC Chewing Gum Company in Britain. And it was a set of cards that were based entirely on What Are Little Girls Made Of?
Yeah, go figure, right? And from what the intro says, that set of cards is worth a heck of a lot of money, because it was only limited to over there. It was a very short run.
Yeah, they're saying what? Some cards go for $10 a card.
Yeah, can you
imagine? So I'd imagine it's pretty pricey to put a whole set together. And that's what makes this book so great, because I'll tell you, last weekend I went here in Jersey. They had the annual Kiss Expo.
Yep.
And you know Kiss is a band that has a lot of merchandise.
They
so,
do.
You know, not every band can do this, and Kiss isn't affiliated with this, but their guitar player was there. But basically, all these vendors come out, and they sell anything you can imagine: old vinyl, old t-shirts, clippings from magazines, all the officially licensed merchandise.
Yep.
And what I'm getting at is a couple of years ago, I think in 2008, they put out these cards called Kiss 360. Mm-hmm. And one vendor was selling them for $1 a pack, and I bought a handful and, you know, threw a couple to my brother and, you know, a couple for myself. And we ended up, you know, going through and trading cards and stuff. So it was kind of fun. But I was thinking about how impractical it is to basically display cards.
Yep.
You know, you put them in a binder or something. You can't really display them unless you like frame them and then hang them on the wall or something. Yep. So that's where I think this book really comes in handy, because you've basically got the entire 88, you know, cards from that series.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love it if they did this with more trading cards, because there were a lot of really cool trading cards. I know when we go to like the you know, the Star Trek convention here in Cherry Hill, and also Monster Mania and Chiller Theater. Mm-hmm. There's people that are always selling complete sets of cards, and yes. I always look at them and I say, I'm going to look at these, and then what am I going to do with them?
Yeah, they're going to sit in a box and collect dust. Now, I think we were probably a month ago now, we were at a con called RetroCon,
mm-hmm.
and I know we were standing there at a vendor looking at he had full sets of cards that were wrapped in plastic.
Yeah.
And you're looking at the cards going, wow, you know, I remember when I was a little kid, the ice cream man used to sell garbage pail kids. And I
yes.
had a whole set of a couple of the different series, and he had all of them pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at these going, you know, I would love to have these, but they would sit on a little shelf here, mm-hmm. and you'd see the front card on the stack and the back of the back card on the stack. And I wouldn't unwrap them because I'd be afraid to damage them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a book like this book, like the top Star Trek card book, is perfect because you can leaf through it. You can see the front and the back on the same page, so you can read the back of the card and see the front of the card and just kind of go through at your leisure and take a look at them all and not have to worry about ruining a set of trading cards.
Yeah, and this book is from the same folks who wrote a book that I really enjoy and that I actually use as a reference guide for this show.
There you go.
Paula Block and Terry Erdman.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a really good job with this. It's called Tops Star Trek, the original Tops Trading Card Series.
Yep.
And it's from Abrams. And if you look in the back cover there, Jeff, you can see that they also have a book based on Garbage Pail Kids.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look that. I'm going to look that up and see if I can pick up a copy, because I have a very fond memories of collecting those cards. But, you know, a couple of other interesting side notes. I'm about halfway through the book. I specifically stopped myself because the day I got it, I was feverishly reading through it because I was really into it. And I said, you know what? I have to put this down because I'm going to read the entire thing in one night. And I didn't want to read the entire thing in one night. I wanted to savor it a little bit more. You know me.
Mm-hmm.
I like to savor experiences and kind of draw them out.
Sure.
So I put it down and I got about halfway through. But one of the really cool things that I found in that book that I really, really like is that the bonus cards in the back make up for a serious deficiency in the original set of cards, don't they?
Yo, yeah, totally.
Yeah, so I was really shocked to find out that Sulu, aside from one card, I believe it was card 16, mm-hmm. has the back of Sulu's head in a shot of the bridge, but it's the only card in the entire series that has Sulu in it.
Yeah.
And I said, wow, what a giant oversight that is. And there's no real explanation as to why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, none of the preface doesn't say anything about it. And we don't know if it's a licensing problem or whatnot. But the bonus cards make up for that.
Yeah, he's in two of those bonus cards.
Yes, and it's mm-hmm. great. And one of the bonus cards, of course, is the swashbuckling Sulu, which is the perfect representation, I think, of one of T'Kai's favorite moments. And one of, I think, a lot of fans' favorite Sulu moments.
Oh yeah, and I mean that was forever captured in the, you know, the end credits of a lot of, you know, the episodes in syndication.
Yep, definitely. So to sum it up, anybody who's listening to this podcast who hasn't picked up this book yet and is a Star Trek fan of the original series, it's definitely worth picking up. The price is great.
Yeah, it's currently under $14 on Amazon with a list price of $19.99, I think so.
Yep, and Prime eligible. Of course, if you're a Prime member, your shipping mm-hmm. is 2 days and free.
Yeah.
So that's how I picked it up. And did you order from Amazon?
Yes, I did. All right. Yeah, I went and looked at it in the store because I couldn't wait. And of course, you know, the store sold it for full retail. And
of course,
if, you know, I mean, not that I mind paying full retail for things, but when I know I can get something for a significantly less amount of money, mm-hmm. I'm going to do that. And then, of course, with the Prime shipping, I mean, you order it on, you know, I think Friday I ordered it, or Friday or Saturday, and it was here Tuesday. So, I mean.
Yeah, I ordered mine on Friday, and it showed up on Monday. So.
All right. Then I must have ordered it on Saturday, and I think then they bump it over. But either way, I mean, the Prime shipping's great, and I mean, not to do a commercial for Amazon here.
Right. Yeah. let's not do that.
But it is a you get a lot of content for not a lot of money. So
yep, and the book is a great showpiece. You put it on a shelf; it looks really, really cool. They mm-hmm. replicated the original packaging, so you have a Kirk and Spock with in that kind of comic hand drawn look with the Enterprise in the background. Really cool to display on a shelf, or you know, even the spine is cool in your bookcase or whatever. So it's a good piece.
Yeah, it's one of those books where it took me a couple times of picking it up and looking at it to see all of the little sort of Easter eggs, if you mm-hmm. will, that are, you know, that are strewn throughout in terms of really replicating the experience of picking up a pack of cards.
Yeah, it's very well done. Absolutely well done. So definitely pick that up if you're on the fence, fall on the good side and pick up the book.
Yes. Now, I know before we get to the episode, which we, you know, I'm looking forward to talking about this one. You have some more news related to Star Trek for us.
Yeah, a couple of quick items. So our buddy Juan Ortiz, everybody's familiar with Juan Ortiz. He's the artist who's been drawing up posters for each episode of the original series and the animated series. So Juan has a set of prints and T-shirts available for October based on The Squire of Gothos, Mudd's Women, Obsession, and the Cloud Minders episode. So if any of those spark your fancy, head over to Juan's site and you can order either T-shirts or prints of those. I took a look at them earlier. They're pretty cool. I know, Craig, you've looked at some of Juan's stuff and you were a fan.
Oh, yeah. I love the concept of coming up with individual artwork for each episode.
Yeah, I like that too. I know we talked about that before. Secondly, and this is kind of a funny one, tongue-in-cheek, and I remember in 2009 when the Star Trek reboot came out and the subsequent sequel that we've been talking about for a while on our intros, a lot of the criticism was around the lens flares. Remember everybody was complaining about the yes. lens flares? So Abrams himself has finally apologized for the flagrant overuse of lens flares. So I thought that was a funny article. I saw that the other day on the internet. So apparently he's now keenly aware that people are not really happy. And he says he's not happy with the amount of lens flare either. So everybody out there who's complained about it, you are now vindicated.
Well, hopefully he trades in those lens flares for wipes, because if the new Star Trek movie he's doing does not have wipe transitions from sequence to sequence, I am going to be very, very upset.
Wow. All right. I am noting that now. So when the next movie comes out in 6 or 7 years, we'll be able to go back and take a look at this episode and remember what you said and compare it to the new movie. And finally, one that I'm simultaneously really happy about and really pissed off about, William Shatner is going to tour in October to promote his new record, which comes out next Tuesday, okay. called Ponder the Mystery. Mm-hmm. And you want to know why I'm not happy?
You're not going to be able to go see him.
You're right, because all of his dates are in California.
Oh, wow.
So the complete opposite side of the country from me and you. Mm-hmm. So neither one of us will be able to go see William Shatner perform any of his new record. Supposedly he's touring with Tony Kaye, who is a okay. former member of Yes, who I'm a fan of. So
yeah.
That would have been a nice thing to see. But of course, all the dates are California, so.
How many dates are there?
I think there were 4 so far. Right. Maybe he'll announce more.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Well, you know, he did that Shatner's World. It started mm-hmm. here on Broadway. And then he toured with that around the country for like well over a year.
Yep. We saw that. So yeah. maybe.
So I wouldn't give up hope yet.
All right. Well, I'm not giving up. Just a little perturbed at this point.
Yeah.
But that's okay. You know, worse things have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with that, that's the remainder of the news. So if you're ready, we can jump into air dates and episode synopsis.
Yeah, sure thing. So this is the Corbomite maneuver, and I'm gonna steal a little bit of your gig here.
Okay.
This is really interesting in the sense that it is the actual after pilots. It's the first produced episode of Star Trek, the original series. It's, you know, the third that was filmed, but it wasn't presented as a pilot. So this is really the first, you know, produced four series episodes of Star Trek. So we have a lot of memorable stuff that happens here.
Yep. It's an interesting episode, and you know, we're going to sit down here and talk about it in a minute. The original air date for this episode was November 10th of 1966. The remaster was December 9th of 2006. This episode in particular, I think, has some of the coolest remastered effects. So, you know, you got your rainbow spinning cube. You've got the gigantic ship made up of the gold spheres that are connected by the metal and the little ship. So you're going to get some really cool remastered effects here if you're sitting down with us and watching the remastered version of this.
Yeah. And like we said, this was the third produced. And of course, we're not talking about it now until episode 10. So, you know, that sequencing is still a little bit of an issue. Let me give you a plot rundown real quick. Okay. Exploring a distant region of space, the Enterprise is threatened by Baylock, commander of a starship from the First Federation.
Yeah, sounds awesome. And we are going to get started with this in 3, 2, 1.
And as always, we have the flyby of the Enterprise in space.
Yes, we do. And this episode is one of a few Star Trek episodes that was nominated for a Hugo Award in 1967 for Best Dramatic Presentation. Great overhead shot here, too, by the way.
Yeah, really showcasing the bridge.
Yep. Well.
And instantly we see this is earlier in the production order because Spock's got his look. His uniform slightly different.
The bigger collar.
And he's doing that sort of, I am going to talk really loudly when I deliver orders. And Uhura is also in a gold
uniform. Yep.
So it's really, I'm really curious as to who was making the decisions as to the order to run these episodes, and it seems like the network was making
a lot of those decisions.
Even today, it seems like networks make decisions that shoot themselves in the foot, and it just doesn't make sense to me. I can't imagine watching this back in the 60s and not being confused week to week in these early episodes.
We're gonna one day maybe we'll have an auxiliary episode where we can bring people on. But I was having a discussion with my uncle who watched these when they were originally broadcast and had a lot of really cool insights.
Oh, awesome.
Into what it was like for him back then because he was in grade school at the time.
Yeah.
So I'm not gonna run through our whole conversation so that way we can actually have it.
Yeah.
But he can speak to exactly what you just said.
All right, awesome. Well, I was actually thinking, and you know, we'll peel back the curtain a little bit, but I was thinking when we're done with season one, we can do a season one wrap up.
Yeah.
And what we can do is we can go through, double check our essential versus non-essential list, and see if we want to change.
Yep.
Come up with the official Tricorder Transmissions essential list.
Yep.
And then also maybe establish a preferred running order based on what we deem essential.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And, you know, give the Tricorder Transmission stamp of approval on how to watch season one.
Phenomenal. Phenomenal.
And then, you know, I'm sure we could definitely bring on people at that point.
It would probably
for a really interesting episode.
Yeah. So another thing just happened here. Spock will issue a red alert order.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. So that's something that doesn't happen very often. Usually it's Kirk who signals the different alert conditions.
Yeah, that's another weird thing about this episode. It starts without Kirk on the bridge with no explanation as to why he's not there.
Well, I think he ate Mexican the night before. So he's a little indisposed, you know. So here we are. We are flying around. We're doing our little intro here. So this is one of the few Star Trek TOS episodes that actually places a timestamp on the events of what happened. So it's kind of if you read through a lot of the wiki stuff on these episodes or some of the books that run down, you know, lists of star dates and stuff, you can see they jump all over the map.
Yeah.
But this episode happens in the same relative time frame as the motion picture does. Isn't that weird? Like, if you look at the dates and the way that star dates and everything line up, it's weird the way the dates jump around. So I think really early on in the series, they weren't really as concerned with time stamping them in a way that made sense. So maybe that's something that evolved later on.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in sick bay, and Kirk is on that bizarro block in the wall, up inverted treadmill stair climber sort of thing again.
Yeah, not the first time we've seen that. No. And it's interesting here, McCoy ignores the red alert.
And it's going to piss Kirk off, too.
Yeah.
Kirk's not going to be happy.
This whole episode, McCoy sort of seems a little off to me.
Yeah. He seems, well, of course, you know, this is early on, and you know, the characters were still sort of baking in a way. So maybe, you know, McCoy would do things in this episode that he wouldn't do later in the series after his character had gelled a little more. So, you know, Kirk has seen the red alert. He's not happy. And now we're seeing the spinning cube. Nice remastered effects on these things. I'll tell you, the large ship.
I'm looking forward to seeing that. I haven't watched it yet.
You haven't watched this yet?
Well, I watched the original broadcast version for my prep.
You are in for a treat, sir.
Oh.
You are in for a treat. The large ship looks really cool.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
I assumed that that was going to have a really cool look. And another thing I noticed was they have a countdown clock, which we've seen earlier in this series as well. And I'm looking forward to seeing the digital version of that.
Mm-hmm.
They replaced sort of the analog version. Very busy Enterprise, I guess, for Red Alert. Everybody gets into motion, and It's interesting that we get to see sort of a shirtless Kirk for as long as we do.
And you get to see some of the operation of the turbo lift here with the rotating handle to start the turbo lift, right?
Yeah, but then you tell it where to go.
Right, isn't that a little bit strange? Yeah. And they kind of change that later. You don't always see them doing that in the turbo lift. Just, I guess, the side shot of Kirk.
Mm-hmm. And there's that wall communicator.
I'm buying that.
Which we were talking about prior to this episode. I found via ThinkGeek, you can buy it and hang it up in your adjacent to a doorway. And when people walk through, they'll get that swoosh sound effect.
I am totally
effect.
Buying that as soon as we're done recording today. In fact, maybe between episodes and lunchtime, I will go on Amazon and buy one of those things.
I look forward to the day where you call me up, Jeff, and say, Craig, you got to come to the house. You got to see this. And I'm going to walk in and you're going to have in like your den a replica of the bridge.
Don't tempt me. Don't tempt me, because I could definitely fab up one of those. I get a friend of mine who knows how to do some good carpentry work.
Uh-huh.
So I think I could make that happen.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm anticipating, getting that call one day, however far in the future it is.
Actually, remember in the Star Trek Experience back in Vegas, they had the hallways that looked like you were on the ship. That is what I would love to have in my house.
Yeah.
Hallways that look like Star Trek hallways.
Yeah. When we go to Vegas later this fall.
This is a handheld shot?
Yeah, very rare handheld shot. You haven't been to the Hilton since they got rid of the Experience, right?
The S-Box?
Yeah.
No, I have not been to the S-Box Hotel.
Yeah. I went after the Experience had shut down just to see what it looked like. And there really is no indication that there was a whole Star Trek-based experience.
Well, that experience is a damn shame.
There is. There's the outside section, you know, that leads to, I guess, the monorail stop, maybe?
Yep.
That sort of still looks like it.
No, that's a shame.
But I think we should really do a full discussion of the Experience at some point down the line.
That could be a supplemental episode.
Yeah,
too,
I've even thought about like trying to track down people that worked there.
Could be an idea.
You know, even like, you know, go have a drink with them or something in Vegas and, you know, just get their
interview
their memories about, you know, working on the Experience.
How would we even do that?
Yeah. Well, you know, in this day and age with the internet, it's a lot easier than it used to be.
Yeah, maybe you could put something out there. Maybe there's some Star Trek forums people might know, people who've been. Mm-hmm. So I think somewhere in this, there it is. You can see James Doohan's hand injury right there when he passed that thermos.
Okay, he's missing a...
He's missing a finger.
Yeah.
So they tried like hell to hide that.
Yeah.
From the cameras, and you very, very rarely ever will see that. But this is one of the only scenes that you could probably have freeze-framed that. When his hand reaches out to grab it, you can see the missing finger.
Well, I'd imagine that would be a deal-breaker in Starfleet. I mean, it would definitely impact your ability as an engineer.
Yeah, well... I guess, yeah, it probably would. Well, I mean, it's his ring finger, I think.
Oh, okay.
So maybe it wouldn't be that crucial.
Mm-hmm.
But interesting conference room scene here where they're actually all sitting around a table talking about this doesn't happen very often either. Usually these types of decisions are made on the bridge in the spur of the moment. They usually don't take time out to convene in a conference room.
Yeah, and you definitely don't need like your communications officer and your helmsman. And your navigator.
I love how those memory tapes they have for the computer are so much bigger than flashcards we have today. Like, you have flashcards the size of your pinky finger.
Yeah.
So they're still being stopped by the spinning cube.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't started to emit any radiation yet right now.
Yeah.
We're not at that point yet.
No.
That will be coming up soon. But still trying to figure out what's going on here.
Yeah,
and one of the cool things is that they added the changing colors as the cube spins. You can see the colors reflecting. You know, when they have the exterior shots of the ship, you can see the colors reflecting, and the lighting is changing here in the bridge here on and off with the colors blinking. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, and the other cool thing about this episode is every week the show started with a voiceover explaining that they were on a 5-year mission to explore strange new worlds, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But in this episode, it's actually spelled out, you know, hey, this is our objective. Yep. We are here traveling through the stars to discover new worlds and meet new civilizations. So I thought it was kind of neat that it's actually in this episode it's spelled out that hey, this is what this is the kind of stuff we're looking for.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
Which I thought was kind of interesting because it's, you know, aside from the intro each week, it wasn't really something that was really focused on.
No. And another interesting side note about this episode is that when they're talking about the cube itself, Sulu mentions that it's 107 meters long on all sides.
Mm-hmm.
So think about that, and then you see the external shot of this tiny cube next to the Enterprise.
How big is the Enterprise?
So think about how big the Enterprise is. So you got to get a sense of size of the ship itself based on, you know, the juxtaposition of the small cube, which is actually 107 meters is pretty big.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, the ship itself, you got to imagine, is gigantic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, especially like I know in the motion picture you have that, you know, great reveal where the ship is in dry dock and Kirk is sort of seeing it for the first time in a while.
And they're flying around it for 45 minutes. Well, and that's in the theatrical release.
Yeah.
It's in the extended edition. They fly around it for an hour and 6 minutes.
Oh, goodness.
As the fanfare plays over and over and over and over.
Yeah, that movie actually starts with an overture.
I know. I am so glad you mentioned that because I thought about this the other day because I just watched that again. And the Blu-ray does feature the overture.
Yeah.
So I can say that I've seen two movies in the theater that had overtures at the beginning like that.
One, Black Hole.
Black Hole was the other one.
Yes.
One of my favorites. So the Black Hole. There's first time the ship's phasers have been fired in the series broadcast.
Okay.
Broadcast.
All right.
So this was originally the first one they shot, right? So if you ran them in production order, they would shoot the phasers in the first episode. Mm. But this is actually the 10th episode they broadcast.
Damn,
the ship's phasers had never been fired before.
That's pretty significant.
Yeah. So pretty cool. Pretty cool.
And they destroyed it.
They did.
Cube has been destroyed.
They did. Well,
roll credits.
You know, granted, they didn't do it until it had to be done.
Yeah,
because the cube was emitting radiation that was going to kill them, right? So I think that's a good indication of their intentions as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So the 5-year mission, they are explorers. They're not out to wage war or take over or disrupt alien life.
Yeah.
They're there to learn things.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hesitant to destroy things unless they become a threat.
Sure.
So that's a good establishing shot and a good establishing little piece of this episode there to let people know. Now, Spock's ears do look a little bit different here.
Yeah, I know last week we were talking about how great his ears looked. And here we're sort of seeing the earlier produced episodes. They didn't have everything as refined. So it is definitely interesting that, you know, last week we were sort of pumping up how great those ears looked, and this week they don't look too hot.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's really cool. And you're getting a little bit of a taste of them actually repairing things on the fly. So you've got guys here who are working on the navigation console with some, you know, different tools, and there's still some wires there and some devices, and there's like, it looks like a little old lunchbox or something they carry stuff around in. And there he is operating the turbo lift again with the handheld.
Yeah. And this sort of is the through line through the episode where we have this struggle between McCoy and Kirk about the navigator, where Kirk's basically saying that he's not working up to his potential. And McCoy's basically arguing that he's being worked too hard.
Yep.
So Kirk has them running drills.
Yep.
Based on the scenario that we just witnessed, he wants them to be at a better response time and a better overall
phaser drills.
Uh-huh. But it is kind of odd to see McCoy, you know, taking such a strong stance in, you know, opposition to Kirk. It's definitely not something I wasn't used to seeing.
No, and I think that that is a really good character building for McCoy's character overall, to see that he, as the ship's doctor, is willing to stand up to Kirk, and he's going to do it several more times in this episode. He's going to, you know, exert his medical expertise. He feels that he's in the right. He's not going to just bow down and let Kirk do whatever he wants, walk all over him.
Yeah. And here's sort of a carryover from the Where No Man Has Gone Before version of the Doctor, which was a different actor and a different character. But they're having a drink.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're sort of taking the edge off.
Yep.
and having a little discussion here.
That'll be a common theme, too, going forward. McCoy, I guess they kind of stopped just short of him being a quote-unquote drunk.
Yeah.
But he's always talking about the drinks.
Mm-hmm.
So is this an actual salad?
It looked like it. I was shocked.
Look at that. Usually you see him eating those little colored cubes.
Yeah. But McCoy has modified Kirk's diet because he put on a couple pounds.
Yeah, man. Kirk's a little pudgy there. He's got room to spare.
Yeah.
And she went to take the booze away.
Yeah.
Don't take the man's booze away.
And I guess we're getting a little bit of an indication of what the yeoman's purpose really was.
Yeah. She was his attendant, kind of. You know, she would, you know, bring his logbook to him. She would bring him his food, take it away. You know, that kind of product. Maybe lay his clothes out. I don't know. I don't know.
Maybe read him a bedtime story at night. Come in.
Moon over Rigel 7. Oh, wait, that's a song.
Yeah. hot cocoa with the marshmallows in it. Because it's cold in space.
It's very cold in space. It's very cold.
I wonder, like, what kind of temperature they maintained on the Enterprise. You know, I mean, they're wearing long sleeve, you know, shirts. And I wonder what Starfleet indicated or, you know, mandated as the I bet you there's books out there that have complete, you know, blueprints for the Enterprise and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure that this has been answered before. But I wonder, like, what temperature they ran it at. You know, year round, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure they could just take it. They probably didn't have to have any sort of an air conditioner or anything. They could just take cold air in from space and use that maybe to cool the air inside the Enterprise. I mean, there's no oxygen, but they could use the temperature of the air to cool the oxygen that was being pumped into the ship.
And here we just saw two people come off the elevator onto the bridge. And again, you know, getting these early episodes that showcase or show a lot more people on the bridge than need to be there. And ultimately, you know, as the series progresses,
they could walk on and off at will.
And here we are seeing the remastered sphere. Definitely looks different than the original broadcast.
Oh, much different.
Yeah, it's
much different. The detail alone.
Yeah.
Wow. It's kind of got a really neat look. It looked like large gems in a way.
Yeah.
They're kind of held together by some sort of a gray metal substructure.
Underneath, but, yeah.
And there's the fascinating line.
Mm-hmm.
So now you can see when they switch to an external view how much bigger this thing is than the Enterprise. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So they're coming in contact with a gigantic, foreboding looking ship.
Yeah. And the voice of this this being Baylock, which at some point they determine its name is Baylock, mm-hmm. Is Ted Cassidy, who we talked about on the What Are Little Girls Made Of episode, Lurch from the Addams Family.
Yep.
He does the voice of this version. There, it turns out that it took a lot of people to make this character come to life, but mm-hmm. The sphere voice version of him is Ted Cassidy. So. He was very involved in this series. It seems, between playing the character he did on What Are Little Girls Made Of, and providing the voice work here.
Huh.
Episode was written by Jerry Soule, who died back in 2002. He was a novelist and a screenwriter, and he penned this episode under the name Nathan Butler. He also wrote for The Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and The Outer Limits, and he also wrote novels, including The Transcendent Man, The Altered Ego, and Point Ultimate.
Wow.
And the episode was directed by Joseph Sargent. He's a 4-time Emmy winner.
Nice.
He directed Jaws the Revenge and the original version of The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
Aha.
So, that's a little bit of info related to the behind the scenes. And the one thing that's interesting is I saw in the notes that he had used the name Nathan Butler, but in the credits, he's credited as Jerry Soule. So I'm not sure if in the actual, Screenwriters Guild or whatever, when it was submitted, or maybe at some point after that, they went back and put his name in. Because I think a lot of times we're watching, even the original versions are versions that were prepped in the 70s for syndication packages and whatnot.
Try to do a little more looking into that and figure out what exactly the deal is with that.
Yeah, and who knows, my research was a little flawed.
Or maybe, you never know, if one of the sources was off, who knows?
Yeah.
Wasn't necessarily anybody's. So we got a little bit of tension going on here. Kirk trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
How to get out of this situation.
Mm-hmm. And again, you've got over his shoulder there with Uhura, a random
guy. Yeah, he's just doing stuff.
Yeah, what purpose is he serving on the bridge there? And he's looking at us now, almost accusing us of saying, hey,
he's just called me out.
But so, it's something that, we're getting to the point where we're going to start seeing less and less of the odd sort of scenarios.
Yep. So the early focus and continued focus through this episode on crewman Bailey himself.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that was intended to foreshadow something happening with him at the end? So, usually we don't really have these. This is pre-Chekhov, of course.
Yeah.
So, you don't really have a lot of focus on, minor non-recurring characters for the most part, crew members like that, unless something's going to happen to them, right?
Yeah.
So I guess you could say, this is early on in the series, but is this one of those situations where, we're going to see at the end something's going to happen to them just because we can glean that just because they're focused on them so much?
Yeah, that definitely was sort of my takeaway from this was, at the end when the suggestion is made, it almost seems like it was telegraphed way in advance. Mm-hmm.
Way in advance,
this was the decision that was going to be made.
Yeah, they got to do something. Either he's going to get shipped, he's going to have to shape up and become, a better bridge. Look at him, he's freaking out. Or they're going to have to get rid of him.
Yeah.
A lot of tension going on here. We're seeing how different crew members react to what could be perceived as, in a no-win scenario or death.
Yeah, well, at this point, they've been given, 8 Earth minutes?
Yep.
to
quote unquote Earth minutes
to pray to their god, basically. Their deity, as he says. This voice from the sphere, he says, "You destroyed our cube. I'm going to destroy you, but I'm going to give you, some time to you know, get your soul in order, if you will.
get your stuff together, man. You guys are going down, and you know, you have no doubt at all that the ship that's out there is capable of destroying the Enterprise. I mean, the sheer size of it alone is ginormous.
Yeah. And it's interesting because we see, as we learn at the end of this episode, you know, what the true intention was.
Yeah.
But you almost wonder if Kirk doesn't make the play that he plays, how Baylock would have responded.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't seem like he ever intended to. Oh, and here's the Baylock puppet.
Here it is.
a pretty iconic image that worked its way into the end credits for. I think he probably saw this in the end credits before it actually made its first full appearance.
Yep. And according to an interview, the original script for this episode called for Spock in particular to recoil when the image of Baylock comes onto the screen.
Interesting.
Yeah. And the director of the episode instead suggested that Nimoy just simply say, "Fascinating."
Yes.
Which would become a defining trait for the Spock character going forward.
Oh, that is cool. That's
so
a cool
imagine what would have happened if they just let that go and he just kind of made that, because that's totally out of character.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty cool that a director can make that significant a contribution to a character just with his own intuition. Just saying, you know what, I think that would be better if you just kind of... Because you would think that Spock as a Vulcan and the Vulcans themselves have been traveling through space far longer than humans were, right?
Yeah,
we didn't necessarily know that at the time.
Yeah.
But we'll come to find out. So it would make more sense for the Vulcans to have seen a heck of a lot more and be surprised by less.
Yeah.
Than humans.
I guess they determined that somebody had to sort of sell the visual horror that this being could instill.
Yeah, and did you notice that the Baylock that we see on the screen almost mimics what modern day alien abduction aliens look like, right? They look like the grays, the quote-unquote grays, except he doesn't have the big black eyes. Yeah. He's got smaller eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But the shape of the head is very similar to what people perceive what aliens would look like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he almost kind of moves like the puppet in the Saw movies.
You know, with that mouth kind of... Yeah.
I can only imagine watching this and being like, oh, that looks... cheap.
Well,
before you realize that it's a puppet.
Back in the day when this aired, I couldn't imagine seeing that on the screen.
Yeah,
you know, that would probably be pretty terrifying, especially the kids.
Oh yeah,
back then you see something that looked like that. Like, yeah. Wow.
Now I'm surprised that the rebooted 2009 or this summer's Into Darkness didn't somehow find a way to sort of put that puppet in as an Easter egg, because you know that series, they've served up quite a few of those little, you know, visual nods
fan service
back to
sort of things.
So I'm surprised that puppet head didn't somehow find its way in, you know.
Well, we're probably holding on to it for another another movie.
Who knows? So, maybe JJ will even co-opt it and use it in Star Trek, Star Wars 7.
Oh, God. So from what I understand, this is the first episode to use the trademark bridge sounds.
Oh, okay.
The first broadcast episode to use the trademark bridge sounds, which Shatner referred to in an interview because somebody had asked him if those sounds were actually playing while they were. Shatner said something to the effect of, everybody on that ship would have gone completely crazy if those sounds were actually being
played over and over.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Another thing about this episode, and I don't know exactly what scene he appears in, but a guy by the name of Jonathan Goldsmith, whose stage name is Jonathan Lip, who is better known as the world's most the most interesting man in the world in the Dos Equis commercials.
Oh, wow, okay.
Appears in this episode somewhere. I'm not sure what scene he's in.
All right.
But he's an unnamed crewman
on
this episode. So the world's most interesting man is on the Enterprise somewhere, which I guess really does make him the world's most interesting man, right?
Yeah. I think in real life he lives up in New Hampshire, and he's Jewish.
Yeah.
You know, he's definitely playing a Latin character, but
yeah,
he's
for
not.
Sure. I have to admit, those commercials are pretty entertaining.
Oh,
at times, yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. A very, very good ad campaign.
Better than Spuds McKenzie was.
I liked Spuds, but yeah, yeah. I can't disagree with you there. And you'd almost think that if Ricardo Montalban had been around, that they would have used him for that.
Oh, probably.
Most interesting man campaign.
Yeah, all we get is the fine Corinthian leather, though. That's all we get from him. That's such a shame.
Mm-hmm. So we've got this countdown.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting close to the point where they're going to be destroyed. And basically, Kirk, you know, comes up with this poker, basically, solution. Where earlier, Spock had said, you know, if this was chess, checkmate. And Kirk gets kind of annoyed that there's, you know, there's no advice that Spock can offer. And then McCoy threatens Kirk with something, and Kirk brings up the word bluff, and it sort of triggers him to start thinking about this like a game of poker. And it's kind of neat.
Bring this up too, yeah.
It's kind of neat to see that, you know, Kirk basically bluffs this alien entity that's threatening to blow them up. And he says, we have this this Corbomite if you destroy us, it'll basically
wipe you out.
So it really shows Kirk thinking on his feet, improvising, and using real world skills to sort of solve their problem.
I think that the I had a couple of notes written for myself to mention. I think because Craig and I both love poker, so that's a kind of a significant tie, personal tie for us to this episode that Kirk understands the game of poker and how to play. And I think the Corbomite maneuver, the bluff that he pulls, I think that solidifies Kirk as a serious badass.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's in the face of certain death and he's not panicking. He's still headstrong enough to come up with a bluff that's going to save the ship, right?
Yeah.
So it's a huge gamble in a no-win scenario. Gigantic gamble. And I think it's another notch in the cap to his legendary status as one of the greatest starship captains ever. I mean, you see the reverence for him in the future. Other characters and other shows have this huge reverence for Captain Kirk, and this is one of the reasons why.
The bravado.
Yep.
And this is where you start sort of coming up with the what if scenario. What if Kirk didn't bluff here? What would have happened?
Yeah. No. I think they would have been done.
Yeah.
They probably would have been done because you obviously Baylock wasn't, you know, I don't want to ruin the rest of the episode, but I guess everybody's probably seen it by now. But I think that Baylock did intend to destroy them because he felt that they were hostile. Yeah. So far they failed the test by blowing up the little probe, right?
Yeah.
The little cube probe. So they show that they have a penchant for violence. So, you know, I think they have to prove to Baylock at this point that, you know, they only acted in self-defense and their intentions aren't evil and violent.
It's funny. We get down to the end of the countdown and Baylock says that your destruction will be postponed until you prove the existence of this Corbomite, which...
Right.
And at that point, he basically tips his hand almost.
Yeah.
You know, he basically shows all his cards to the Enterprise in terms of that he might not be as strong as they think he is.
So another note on relative size of things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was remarked earlier in this episode when the ship, that large ship, the giant sphere ship, is a mile in diameter. A mile. That is huge.
Yeah.
A mile. What the hell is inside that thing? It's a mile in diameter. But That's not the only interesting thing, though. I was wondering, why are they using miles, the American system of measurement, as opposed to the metric system?
Yeah.
Because a lot of other things in this show are measured in metric.
Mm-hmm.
So why would that measurement have been given in miles? Because they measure the cube in meters.
It's so much more meters. Impressive to
I
say
guess so.
Mile.
Maybe. Well, you guys, so for American audiences, you want them to get the size of the ship, so you say it's a mile in diameter. You think a mile is, well, it's a pretty significant distance.
Yeah, yeah.
So for this for size of a ship, I mean, think about the time when this show was broadcast. What were the biggest you know, moving objects around, vehicles, battleships maybe? They're not even close to a mile long, right? So, you know, large jetliners, you know, they're big, but they're nowhere near as big as a mile. Mm-hmm. So for relative size.
And there's more of that Spock barking his...
The loud Spock.
Yes.
The carryover from Where No Man Has Gone Before, the second pilot where he's screaming out all of his orders. Yeah. And here's the wavy Baylock image again. It's coming back on. It's going to explain some things.
There's that head turn like the Saw puppet.
Yeah. You know, I don't... I maybe now, looking at it through, you know, 2013 eyes, maybe it does look a little puppetish. Mm-hmm. But I mean, back then, I think when the show was originally on the air, that was probably pretty realistic.
Sure. Man. Yeah. I mean, the biggest giveaway are the eyes.
Sure.
You know, it's hard to fake. It's hard to fake eyes, especially when you're doing eyes that have pupils. And so here comes Yeoman.
Did she bring him coffee?
Coffee. Yeah. And she heated it up with her phaser, as she explains.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the other aliens, like the Gorn, obviously the Gorn, he doesn't have eyeballs.
No.
So the Gorn's a lot easier to sell as being a living, breathing being.
Yeah, he's got those kind of tennis ball looking things sticking out of his head. You notice, though, we'll come back to your point from earlier. There's a hell of a lot of people on the bridge just hanging around. Why is Scotty there?
Yeah.
Shouldn't he be in engineering? Mm-hmm. I mean, just kind of hanging around on the bridge.
Yeah.
And Uhura just kind of standing there in the background. She's not at her station.
Yeah.
And Kirk is drinking coffee.
Yeah. At least Uhura has a reason to be there.
Like, Spock's the only one doing anything.
Yeah. McCoy's there too as well.
Yeah, what's he doing? Don't you have something to do in sick bay?
Yeah.
And see, this is why you shouldn't be hanging around the bridge. There's not enough seating for everybody. And, you know, when the ship rumbles... So now we got a tractor beam situation here. Little ship is going to be pulling along the big old Enterprise.
And this is pretty much where things come off the rails for Baylock in terms of the balance of power shifts from him to the Enterprise and Kirk.
And you know, you're going to see here shortly Kirk's combat prowess, his tactical abilities. I mean, the guy, he's sharp. He can figure things out. He's going to figure out some stuff about this little ship and the power, the relative amount of power it takes to do this and, you know, and tow a ship size of the Enterprise, and he's going to figure things out. And I think this episode is a great, great showcase for Kirk and his ability to not only be great in a combat scenario, but also, you know, it, combined with other episodes and other moments of his, it kind of rounds out his capabilities and shows you what a well-rounded captain he is. He doesn't seem to have a lot of weak points as far as command is concerned.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny because in a lot of TV shows and movies, we're told somebody is good at their job and that's it.
Right.
You know, we're never shown, you know. Like even here on Star Trek, you see Scotty. He is a brilliant engineer. You
don't
really see what he's doing. You know, I mean, it's explained what he's doing. But you just sort of take everybody's word that, hey, Scotty's the man for the job.
Sometimes you see him laying underneath the console with a tool.
Yeah.
You're not exactly sure.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you definitely make a good point here in the sense that there's concrete stuff being laid out that shows why Kirk is captain of a starship.
Yep. So you would think in situations like these, you know, the things that they're going to run into, they had no idea what they were going to run into in this 5-year mission, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the brilliance of whoever it was who made the decision to put Kirk in that seat, you know, obviously they had to pick somebody who not only could understand how to perform exploration missions, mm-hmm. You know, put people around him who could support him scientifically, but you also had to have somebody who could think critically, mm-hmm. someone who could react in potential life and death scenarios. And Kirk seems to be able to fit every one of those scenarios, you know, pretty well. There's times, of course, where he has to rely on the people around him to help him make decisions.
Yeah, that's what your crew's
like
for.
A good captain is, should do. But, you know, on his own, he's really able to think through a lot of these. This is a really cool remastered effect, by the way.
Yeah.
The ship strobing on and off.
And they're pretty much, they're stressing the the ship that's dragging them. They're stressing it to the point where it's going to lose its ability to support
the life. Tractor beam and life. Yeah, right? Kirk has assumed that their tractor beam must use an intense amount of power for a ship that small
to pull such a large
ship. So, yeah, now he's trying to actively strain that power drain even more. And we'll find out shortly that he's going to be pretty successful. But I really love that remastered effect with the strobing ship. Looks really, really cool.
Yeah. This episode is kind of funny for me in the sense that after all said and done, the threat didn't seem big enough to warrant a 50-minute episode. It almost seems like...
Yeah, they kind of had to stretch it out a bit.
Yeah, well, yeah, it just seems like once you have the reveal, it almost seems like, wow, so there really wasn't much going on here.
Yeah.
And maybe that, you know, that explains why it was sort of put in the running order where it was instead of, you know, leading with this as your second or third episode.
Yeah.
You know, you sort of, you know, put it week 10. So, you know, you get some of your stronger material up front.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, back when we talked about the man trap, the network opted to air that episode because of the action, you know, so the alien and the, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on and the monster.
Yeah.
You know, so this episode, of course, happens completely on the ship.
Yeah.
And it's more of a mental episode. Mm-hmm. It's more of a thinking exercise. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it does seem to make sense that they would push this out in the running order a bit.
Yeah.
So and try to capture an audience straight off with a monster. So it looks like they're having a measure of success here, straining against the small. You see a lot of the camera tilting going on here.
Yeah, and it's interesting that in the remastered version here, the small ship has gone from, you know, individual spheres that you can make out to sort of just radiating light that sort of looks like it's all sort of melting together.
Yeah, it's a kind of a cluster.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess as their power usage is becoming more and more intense, that light, that glow is getting more and more intense. So it almost starts to look like astral.
Yeah.
In a way. Yep. And there we go. And
they're free.
I think that these remastered effects actually add quite a bit to these episodes. When you see the ship break off like that and the other the little ship kind of drift off, I think it's really cool. The more I watch these, the more I like them.
Yeah.
You see how Scotty balls up his fist like that so that you don't see his finger missing?
Mm-hmm.
You would never really even notice.
Yeah. It would have been cool and it would have fit his character if Scotty wore sort of the one black glove, you
know? The Luke Skywalker one black glove.
Or like, you know...
Michael Jackson sparkly glove. Yeah.
Or the Samoan lawyer in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. You know, it would have fit for Scotty. I mean, it totally would have worked.
Yeah, it might have. It might have. Oh. And so, we got a little smile from McCoy back there as they realized that the plan succeeded. But see, now we're going to see another. Kirk is going to yet again shift gears, right? And he shifts right out of combat mode and right into this, the explorer, you know, Starfleet captain, prime directive mode where he's going to save Baylock, which is really, I think, is fantastic insight.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, then again, it's almost an opposite of the way they react to the man trap, where it's, hey, it's less of its kind, but kill it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we could probably debate, you know, the ethics of what they did in the man trap for, you know, the rest of the season one discussion that we have, you know, allotted in front of us.
We probably will. Well, I'm only going to bring it up where it's applicable. Yeah, you know, I'm not going to beat it to death because, you know, we probably couldn't agree on it. But at any rate.
Yeah. No, but it is a sort of, you are seeing sort of, this is what they're out there to do.
Yep.
And that's what makes this episode sort of worthwhile and special for me is, you know.
And here's a rare instance where Spock is going to be denied
going
a place in the landing party.
Yeah.
And he's a little disappointment on his face there. You're like, no, Spock, you're not coming.
It's going to be, it's more convenient.
You would think that Spock would be valuable in that particular instance. You're leaving aboard an alien craft. You don't know what you're dealing with.
But I think Kirk's explanation makes sense. He says, if something happens to us, I need somebody on ship that can, you know, that can take command.
Yep. And I think that is that also establishes Kirk's faith in Spock and in Spock's abilities.
Mm-hmm. So here you see them sort of suiting up for their away, mission, which is really weird to see because it's something that they eventually lose. And they're also instructed to duck down because they've determined that the corridor that they're beaming into is of a smaller height.
You always wonder what would happen if you beam somebody partially into something, like a wall.
Yeah. The transporter technology overall, to me, is terrifying.
It is. It is terrifying.
And I can imagine how long that was in trial for before they...
If they were to invent something like this today, I guarantee you we wouldn't be able to use it commercially for 10 to 15 years because the just the insurance alone, right? And here we find out
we discover that the Baylock is a puppet.
Yep. Pretty cool looking puppet though, man.
I wonder if that survived. Oh God. And there he is.
Oh, this creeps me out, man.
Lil Clint Howard, Howard's brother.
Creeps me out, man. And he's like laying seductively on that couch. Oh God.
Well, he's bald.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is very, very off-putting. Ugh. Especially, you know, a lot of times when you see a bald child, you know, it's probably cancer related.
Yeah.
Whereas here he's bald for some other reason. Well, he's an alien, also not a child. He's using a man's voice. They've overdubbed a male voice.
And I guess maybe that's why they picked him, because he's so weird looking.
Yeah.
You know, and the Tranya is actually grapefruit juice.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, and Clint Howard did not like grapefruit juice.
That's fine. As a child, I did not like grapefruit or grapefruit juice. It's very, it's got a very, very...
It's like a tart.
Yeah.
Sort of. I mean, I don't like it or dislike it. I can drink it, but... You know, look, he's got it in a punch bowl with a ladle. I guess that's a universal thing. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, not just related just to Earth. And they drink it.
Yeah, well, it seems like Kirk sort of gives him that look like, hey, are you attempting to poison us here? And then he shows, hey, I'll take a drink too.
Yeah, but that's no proof of anything.
Yeah.
Because it may be something that's lethal to humans. I'm surprised McCoy didn't try to test it first.
Yeah.
Right? And they relish it as much as he did.
Yeah.
I hate the word relish. I really hate that. But, well, you know, they're brave, I guess. They figure they got out of the situation. I guess they figure, you know, Baylock isn't going to try to kill him with poison. So
we've had the Baylock puppet.
Yep.
And the sphere voiced by Ted Cassidy.
Yep.
We have Clint Howard playing the physical version of Baylock. And... somebody providing the voice, and my research has sort of come up with two different possible people.
Okay.
The internet basically says it's Walker Edmondson, who died back in 2007, and among other things, is popular as being the voice of Ernie the Keebler Elf.
Oh.
but my book, Star Trek 365, credits the voice to Vic Perrin, So I'm going to have to do some additional research and sort of get to the bottom of whose voice this is.
I wonder what that's
about.
It
seems like Walker Edmondson is the guy based on all the research I've done, but I can't discount Star Trek 365 based on the people involved in it. So basically they come to the conclusion that they're going to do an information exchange here.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically going to have somebody spend a couple years with Baylock giving the human perspective on things, and he's going to share their alien version of things.
Yep. And here's the foreshadowing of crewman Bailey paying off.
Yeah. And Kirk holds his hand, even though he's not a baby or a child. They hold hands. Which
isn't that cute?
It's kind of neat to see.
And they kind of walk off into the curtain there.
Yeah.
To do who knows what.
Yep. So now as they sort of go off into the sunset, if you will, we'll get into the essential nature of this episode, and I will let you lead.
Oh, thanks, man.
Okay.
So, I don't know if I'm just going to come out and say it, but I guess I would consider this an essential episode.
Mm-hmm.
For quite a few reasons. I'm not going to discount my creep-outness at Clint Howard, but I'm going to let that slide. I think this episode is a great one for Kirk. Mm-hmm. I think his character building in this is fantastic. You see him as a brilliant tactician. You see how he deals with the no-win scenario, which is going to come up time and time again. But this is a great early look at how he deals with difficult situations, how he deals with crewmen who are not performing up to their potential.
Mm-hmm.
And you also see his ability to shift gears when he's actually dealing with Baylock after they break free and Baylock's death is certain.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk can shift gears and go into a more of a preservation, more of a diplomatic role. And also, it's a great episode for McCoy.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can see here that McCoy doesn't just do whatever the captain wants him to do. He is a medical professional.
Mm-hmm.
He is going to stand up to Kirk when he feels it's necessary.
Yeah.
So another really great character building moment. So definitely on the essential list for me.
Yeah. I won't repeat much of what you said. I will just say it is essential, mainly for the Kirk moments. Kirk utilizing an approach, a poker-based approach, yep. shows his ability to think on his feet and think outside the box. And all the other stuff you mentioned. So even though this isn't that exciting of an episode,
no,
the moments where we see Kirk using his mind,
yeah,
really, you know, make it worthwhile.
Open your mind.
And I will echo you and say this is definitely an essential episode.
Yeah, I had a note too to say that I think the Baylock puppet alien is also great too. That's another really cool. I couldn't imagine watching the original series and not seeing that.
Well, yeah, and you know, yeah, especially since it turned up in the end credits every
right.
week.
Right, you wonder where the heck it came from. So it's cool to see where it came from.
Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the end of another week. And next week we have an exciting two-part.
Yeah.
The only two-part episode ever.
Yes.
The Menagerie Parts 1 and 2. So make sure you come back and join us next week. As we talk more Star Trek. And as always, thank you for listening.
Same Trek time, same Trek channel. I would have all kinds of references here. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week for the Menagerie.
About chess, Mr. Spock. Poker. Do you know the game? Ship to ship.
Hailing frequencies open, sir.
This is the captain of the Enterprise. Our respect for other life forms requires that we give you this warning. There's one critical item of information that has never been incorporated into the memory banks of any Earth ship. Since the early years of space exploration, Earth vessels have had incorporated into them a substance known as corbomite. It is a material and a device which prevents attack on us. If any destructive energy touches our vessel, a reverse reaction of equal strength is created, destroying...
You now have 2 minutes.
Destroying the attacker. It may interest you to know that since the initial use of Corbomite more than two of our centuries ago, no attacking vessel has survived the attempt. Death has little meaning to us. If it has none to you, then attack us now. We grow annoyed at your foolishness.